encourage the government-supported venture capital fund started in 1999 for low- and moderate-income neighborhoods. Known as the Community Development Financial Institutions Fund, it gives startup financing to entrepreneurs ready to make risky investments in underdeveloped districts, where they see the market possibilities for anything from private daycare centers to low-income housing to a beauty salon to entertainment facilities, but where venture capital financing wouldn't normally be made available. The trampolines. Second, even with a growing economy, every society also needs trampolines, programs that can catch workers who fall behind in this rapidly changing environment and retrain them so they can bounce back into the economy. A trampoline is strong enough to catch you before you hit the ground, but not so cushy that you can live on it forever. And it can be very useful for constantly shrinking the pool of left-behinds. Without question, the most important trampoline is lifelong learning. Every worker needs to understand that economic security in this world without walls cannot come any longer from the largesse of a welfare state or from holding fast to a union card. It can only come from holding a report card. In an age when technological change is so rapid and the walls around companies and countries so small, only new skills and lifelong learning can ensure job security. In your career, knowledge is like milk, says Lewis Ross, chief technology officer for Ford Motor Company. It has a shelf life stamped right on the carton. The shelf life of a degree in engineering is about 3 years. If you're not replacing everything you know by then, your career is going to turn sour fast. As Jim Botkin and Stan Davis note in their book, The Monster Under the Bed, in the knowledge economy, you don't earn a living, you learn a living. Government's job is not to shield workers from this reality, but to empower them to deal with it, and to let them know that it is not a battle they will have to fight on their own. To that end, I believe that each White House should offer in this era of globalization an annual piece of legislation that I would call the Rapid Change Opportunity Act. It would go alongside whatever integrationist policy the administration was pursuing that year, whether it be NAFTA expansion to Chile or any other free trade arrangements. The Rapid Change Opportunity Act would vary each year. Its goal would be to create both the reality and the perception that the government understands that globalization is here and that it spreads its blessings most unevenly. Therefore, the government is constantly going to be adjusting its trampolines to get as many people as possible up to speed for the fast world by expanding their capabilities and life choices. This is the only sustainable way to widen the winner's circle of those benefiting from globalization. If I could have waved a magic wand, the Rapid Change Opportunity Act for 1999, for example, would have included the following: pilot projects for public employment for temporarily displaced workers, tax breaks for severance pay for displaced workers, free government-provided resume consultation for anyone who loses a job, and a further extension of the Kassebaum-Kennedy Act, so that laid-off workers could keep their health insurance policies longer, and a national advertising campaign for one of the best but most underreported bipartisan achievements of the Clinton era, the Workforce Investment Act. Signed in August 1998, it consolidated the government's 150 different job training programs into three broad grants: individual training accounts that workers can use for any training they believe will most advance their job opportunities, one-stop career centers for every job training program, and an increase in youth training programs by $1.2 billion over 5 years. In addition, I would have included in my Rapid Change Opportunity Act some increased U.S. lending to the Asian, African, and Latin American development banks to promote training of women, microlending to women and small businesses, and environmental cleanup in every developing country with which America has significant trade. I would have included an increase in funding for the International Labor Organization's new initiative for building alternatives to child labor in countries where children are most abused. I would have included an increase in the already existing Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, which provides some small income support and training for anyone who can show that his or her job was eliminated because of trade. I would have expanded the already existing Dislocated Worker Training Program to assist anyone who lost a job because of new technology. And finally, I would have launched a national advertising campaign to better inform people about the already existing Lifelong Learning Tax Credit, which allows citizens to write off from their income taxes up to $1,000 of the cost of any education or training program they sign up for to upgrade their education or technical skills. I will also have included programs for reinforcing families and communities, which help provide workers with the psychological supports that are needed to thrive in today's high-pressure, high-speed labor markets. These could have included anything from increasing support for child daycare centers for working parents, to insisting that every worker have a choice between flex time, which he can use for himself or family, and overtime pay. We need to have more self-reliant individuals in this system, but individuals cannot thrive in a vacuum. They need to be supported by more active, healthy, and responsive communities that can help cushion people from either unchecked markets or overbearing governments. Trying to build more civic capacity from the PTA to community policing to fill that gap between markets and government is critical in this new system. The point is that we integrationist social safety netters believe that there are a lot of things government can still do in this era of globalization that is not all that expensive, does not involve radical income redistribution, or lavish compensatory welfare spending programs that would violate the economic rules of the golden straitjacket, but can meaningfully expand the winner's circle. These sorts of initiatives say to citizens, while today's globalization system is asking you to leap from trapeze to trapeze, higher and higher, faster and faster, farther and farther, the government is not going to just let you fall to the jungle floor and be eaten by the lions of globalization. While it won't give you a handout anymore, it will give you a hand up. Even if we waste some money on these hand-up programs, the costs are so small compared to the benefits and efficiencies that come from keeping our markets as free and open to the world as possible. Something like a Rapid Change Opportunity Act is a tiny price to pay for maintaining the social cohesion and political consensus for integration and free trade. Hence my mottos, protection, not protectionism. Cushions, not walls. Floors, not ceilings. Dealing with the reality of the fast world, not denying it. The safety nets. Third, and finally, we still need traditional safety nets. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, and welfare to catch those who simply will never be fast enough or educated enough to deal with the fast world, but who you don't want just falling onto the pavement. In the globalization system, though, we are going to have to rethink what constitutes a safety net. For instance, in an era in which access to the Internet is going to be essential for learning, reserving an airline ticket, dealing with the government, communicating, not to mention shopping at the best price, we may decide that universal access to the Internet is a basic human right. Obviously, there is a trade-off between the trapeze, the trampoline, and the safety nets. What politics is about in America today and in so many other countries is trying to locate that new equilibrium point, trying to determine what is the right mix of an open integrationist economy that is always producing more and more jobs with the right trampolines and safety nets. Clearly, that equilibrium point has been and will continue moving to the right of center, from the left center where it was during the Cold War, when governments felt it was both necessary and possible, in a world of walls, to prevent workers from being attracted to communism by maintaining elaborate welfare state programs. Those days are over, but it doesn't mean simply surrendering everything to the private sector. Thanks to integrationism, America's golden straitjacket is producing enough gold, with a substantial budget surplus projected into the new millennium, to afford both social safety nets and trampolines. No politics of sustainable globalization would be complete, though, if it relied exclusively on economic programs. While expanding access to globalization is critical, particularly for developing countries, simultaneously democratizing their political systems is just as important. This is one of the real lessons of globalization's first decade. Getting your society up to speed for globalization is an enormously wrenching process, and because of that, it requires more democracy in the long run rather than less. In the Cold War, the leaders of developing countries had superpower patrons who would sustain them, no matter how they ran their countries. But those patrons are gone now, and the masses are not going to sustain failed governments for long, not in an age when they can see how everyone else is living. See dictionary entry for Indonesia. If you fail now, you will fall, and unless your people catch you and support you, you will fall hard. See dictionary entry for Suharto. As democracy scholar Larry Diamond has pointed out, we have now seen a number of examples where countries in Latin America, Eastern Europe, and East Asia have voted out of office governments they associated with the pain of globalization reforms. The new governments that came in made some adjustments, but kept more or less the same globalizing, marketizing policies. How did they get away with that? Because the democratic process gave the public in these countries a sense of ownership over the painful process of economic policy reform. It was no longer something completely alien that was being done to them. They were being consulted on it and given a choice about at least the speed of the process, if not the direction. Moreover, as a result of the opportunity to participate in the process and throw out people who they felt had moved too harshly and abruptly, or too corruptly or insensitively, the whole process had much greater political legitimacy, and thus more sustainability. Moreover, where parties and leaders have alternated in power and political oppositions have come in and pursued pretty much the same policies of economic liberalization and globalization as their predecessors, the message sinks into the public that there really is no alternative to the golden straitjacket. How many Latin American, Eastern European, and now East Asian opposition leaders have come into office in the last decade and said, "Gee, it turns out we really are bankrupt. We really do have to open up. In fact, things are even worse than I thought, and we are going to have to accelerate these reforms because there's no way out. But we'll put a human face on them." Democratization helps make that coming to terms with reality possible. And that's why the countries that are adjusting best to globalization today are often not the naturally richest ones, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, or Iran, but rather the most democratic ones, Poland, Taiwan, Thailand, Korea. Democratizing globalization, it's not only the most effective way to make it sustainable, it's the most self-interested and moral policy that any government can pursue. Geoeconomics for the Age of Globalization. I once wrote a fictional column about investing in the 1990s that went something like this. So I decided to do a little international investing. I brushed up on my German and bought some German corporate bonds. I studied a little Japanese and picked up a few stocks on the Nikkei. I got a tip from a waiter at my local Chinese House of Hunan and bought a few shares on the Shanghai Stock Exchange. My broker tried to sell me some Lebanese government bonds, but I told him that I already had wallpaper in my office. I even did my thing for Russian reform by brushing up on the Cyrillic alphabet and buying a few Russian T-bills. But after all my language training and foreign research, I discovered that I forgot to learn just two little English words, Alan Greenspan. Because when Greenspan suddenly raised interest rates in the mid-1990s, making the extra interest I was getting on my foreign bonds less attractive, everyone started dumping these foreign markets and bringing their money home, and I got creamed. I was a bad lender. I had not done my homework. I was just chasing higher rates of return. I didn't know what I owned when I went into these countries, and I didn't know what I owned when I left. Well, over the years, I got a little smarter and became a better lender with my money. I started doing my international investing through a mutual fund that specialized in global markets and could scrutinize each investment. A short time after Russia's economy went into a tailspin in August 1998, I got a letter from that fund, Tweedy Browne Global, reporting that its profits were down a bit because of the general turmoil in international markets that was triggered by Russia's default. But the fund was not down as much as many others because it had actually done its homework and stayed away from Russia. The Tweedy letter said of Russia, "We cannot understand investing in countries with little political stability, no laws protecting investors, and a currency that may be put to better use as Kleenex." Yes, the letter added, in early 1998, the Russian market increased fivefold and then, overnight, lost 80% of its value. A complete round trip. Russia, it turns out, was a bad borrower. It had no operating system and no software, and in the end, all it could offer its investors was a round trip from 0 to 80% and back again to zero. I tell these two stories because they capture in microcosm the two biggest threats to today's global financial system: crises triggered by bad lenders and crises triggered by bad borrowers. Just as you always have both drug users and drug pushers, in global economics, you always have both bad borrowers, such as Russia, and bad lenders, such as myself. The big geoeconomic question we need to address is, how do we stabilize this global economy to make it less susceptible to bad borrowing and bad lending, which today can get so big and spread so fast that it can rattle the whole system? Let's start with the problem of the bad borrowers. I believe globalization did us all a favor by melting down the economies of Thailand, Korea, Malaysia, Indonesia, Mexico, Russia, and Brazil in the 1990s, because it laid bare a lot of rotten practices and institutions in countries that had prematurely globalized. Exposing the venal and corrupt Suharto family in Indonesia was no crisis in my book. Exposing the crony capitalism in Korea was no crisis in my book. Exposing the totally corrupt insider dealings in Thailand was no crisis in my book. Exposing the absurd lengths to which the Mexican government had gone to attract short-term dollar loans without an ability to repay was no crisis in my book. All these systems would have crashed sooner or later. But now that globalization has helped that happen sooner, the question is, what do we do with this opportunity? Some want to restrain the electronic herd from ever stampeding such countries again. Others want to encourage these countries to impose capital controls that will fence the herd out. Both these approaches are wrong-headed. The electronic herd is the energy source of the 21st century. Countries have to learn to manage it. Restraining it is futile, and shutting it out for long will only deprive a country of resources, technology, and professional advice, and prolong crony capitalism. Many experts point to Chile's capital controls as a positive example of what developing countries can do to prevent stampedes. Since 1991, Chile required foreign investors who put money into the Chilean market to keep it there for a minimum of 1 year. It also imposed an implicit tax on Chilean companies engaged in foreign borrowing. The results have been mixed at best. Forbes, May 18, 1998, quoted a study done by Sebastian Edwards, the former World Bank chief economist for Latin America, that showed the Chilean controls to have been only partially effective and significantly increased the cost of capital in Chile. For example, Chile's borrowing costs were roughly double those in Argentina, where a currency board prohibited capital controls. Capital controls are an invitation to let bureaucrats and cronies allocate capital rather than the marketplace. As a temporary measure to stabilize an economy, they can be useful and effective, provided the government fixes the currency at a very low competitive rate. But in the long run, they are no solution. In relatively non-corrupt countries such as Chile, capital controls will eventually lead to distortions. In already corrupt countries, they will make the corruption that much worse. The right geoeconomic approach, therefore, is to focus on strengthening these bad borrowing countries so that they can plug into the herd again. Stampedes will still happen, and some countries no doubt will be unfairly hurt, but the herd is never irrational indefinitely. With rare exceptions, it doesn't run away from or attack countries with sound financial systems pursuing sound economic policies. Some people talk about Thailand, Korea, Indonesia, and Russia, and bemoan what the herd did to them in stampeding away, as if they were practicing textbook economics, and the herd just decided to bolt one day for no reason at all. That's nonsense. They were engaged in bad borrowing, and bad borrowing always involves governments and business running up massive short-term debts, usually denominated in a foreign currency, that cannot be spent rationally and are highly vulnerable to currency swings. Once the herd realizes the excess, it bolts. As U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers once put it, "While it has become fashionable to blame capital account crises on a voracious global capital market, a large part of the problem in these crises came from governments' own efforts to attract short-term inflows that could not reasonably be sustained. We saw this, for example, in Mexico, with the increasing resort to issuing dollar-indexed peso bonos in the lead-up to crisis. We saw it in Thailand in tax breaks for offshore foreign borrowing. And we saw it in Russia in the government's effort to attract foreign capital to the domestic bond market." Economists and bankers today will debate the details for rehabilitating a bad borrowing country and making it more stampede-proof. And each country is somewhat different. But generally speaking, the approach has to include the following four steps. Step one is to make clear to bad borrowing countries that their goal should be to restore the necessary conditions for growth and attracting back the electronic herd. That means a credible commitment to improve its economic operating system over time from Das Kapital 1.0 toward 6.0. This clearly requires some mix. It will differ from country to country, of budget cutting, closing down of inefficient, bankrupt firms and finance houses, currency adjustments, interest rate adjustments, debt write-downs, and the breakup of crony capitalist practices. The aim of such reforms is to stabilize their currencies, eventually lower their interest rates to stimulate demand at home, and improve the prospect that contracts will be respected. In many cases, this step needs to include a process for actually making it easier for the electronic herd to buy companies in these weakened economies. I realize the last point is controversial. It sounds as if I'm trying to make the world cheap and safe for American capitalism. I am not. I am trying to make the world safe for globalution and the creative destruction that is essential to capitalism. eliminating inefficient firms and replacing them with better managed and capitalized ones operating according to the best international standards. I don't care whether the foreign buyers are American, German, Japanese, or Indian. I only care about their standards and capitalization. The state of Arizona used to have a notorious crony banking system. The best thing that ever happened to Arizona was when interstate banking allowed banks that had better technology, were better run and better capitalized, from New York, Chicago, and San Francisco, to come in and buy up Arizona banks. An important reason Argentina recovered faster from the Latin American financial crises of the early 1990s was because a good portion of its banking system was taken over by the best international banks. Having the electronic herd come back to your country, with the confidence to invest long-term capital, to transfer technology, and to provide cutting-edge management for factories, is one of the most effective and quickest ways to build a better local operating system. And frankly, the fear of the herd bolting away again is one of the best long-term sources of discipline to keep a country constantly improving its software and operating systems. Korea, unlike the other Asian tigers, always tried to block foreign investment during its development drive from the 1960s to the 1990s. Instead, it financed its own growth through its own savings and borrowings in order to remain financially independent. But the Asian economic crisis forced Korea to permit foreigners to buy into its ailing industries, and these foreigners are slowly bringing a new business culture to Korea, with more transparency and shareholder control. Step two is to persuade these bad borrowing countries to reform not just their operating systems, but also their political ones, to curb corruption and tax cheating, and improve their rule of law and democracy software, so that when the belt tightening comes, people have a sense that there is some basic fairness to the reform process. It was simply no accident that the two countries least affected by the Asian economic downturn in 1998 were the two countries with the most vibrant democracies and the freest press, Taiwan and Australia. Some would say that China was not affected, but China's economy was not fully plugged into the system and still had a lot of walls around it in the financial arena. Countries basically get the economic outcomes they deserve, and those outcomes are directly related to the quality of their operating systems and software and their degree of democracy. Which is why step three is to ensure that any balance of payments assistance, recovery loans, or debt restructuring provided by the IMF or any other international financial institutions is provided on the condition that steps one and two are taken. The explicit goal of any IMF assistance should be restoring stability, growth, and confidence, so that the electronic herd, both within the affected country and from abroad, will want to resume investment. Treasury Secretary Summers had it exactly right when he argued that the future role of the IMF should be to catalyze market-based solutions and to promote the disclosure of accurate, timely, and wide-ranging financial data that can be used by the herd to make better informed investment decisions. In a world in which the private sector is now the overwhelming source of capital and innovation for growth, there can be no sustained recovery without it. Step four has to be a commitment to use some of the IMF or other assistance to maintain minimum social safety nets in these countries and provide public works jobs to soak up some of the unemployed. These minimum safety nets are often the first things to get shredded in any rescue program. International bankers, who tend to focus only on preventing bank defaults in other countries and not worry about their depressions, poo-poo the issue of safety nets when it comes to helping the bad borrowers. This is insane, because at the end of the day, the real crisis in these bad borrowing countries and the threat they can pose to the global system is not economic. It's political. Here's why. In exposing rotten practices in bad borrowing countries, globalization not only flattened their crony capitalists, but also steamrolled a lot of little folks who were just working hard, playing by the rules of their systems, and assuming everything was okay. They didn't know their countries had false bottoms. But when the floor caved in Russia, Mexico, Thailand, Indonesia, and Brazil, it produced massive layoffs, unemployment, disinflation, fiscal contraction, and collapsing real incomes. That's why it is critical to maintain some basic safety nets and jobs programs during the recovery process. No jobs and no safety nets is no way for a government to buy the patience needed for reform policies to take hold and put a bad borrowing country onto a sustainable growth track. If large numbers of people start to go hungry in big countries, their leaders will be sorely tempted to just opt out of the system, build walls of protection, and engage in beggar-thy-neighbor policies of competitive devaluations, even if it makes no long-term sense. These are the sorts of policies that helped make the Great Depression great and brought us World War II. The other type of global economic crisis that can threaten the whole system is the crisis of bad lenders, from banks to mutual funds to hedge funds, which are now able to lend so much money to so many people in so many places that when they engage in reckless lending on a massive scale and then suddenly try to get their money back, they have the potential to inflict serious damage on both good economies and bad ones. Unlike bad borrowing, which poses a primarily political threat to the system, bad lending on a global scale poses a real financial threat to the system. Bad lending comes in many forms. I was a bad lender when I invested in emerging markets without having a clue about how these countries really operated. Some of the worst lenders in recent years have been big banks. A friend of mine who works in the Hong Kong market once remarked that during the height of the Asian economic boom in the early 1990s, Germany's Dresdner Bank was telling its manager in Asia quite bluntly, "Lend, lend, lend, otherwise we will lose our market share." Banks make money by lending, and each bank assumed that Asia was a no-brainer, and each did not want to lose that market to the other. So they shoved money out the door, just like drug dealers. Their motto to the developing world was, "Come on, kid, just try a little of this cash. The first loan's free." That's why at the beginning of 1999, even after the Southeast Asia-Russia crises, the top 500 banks from the 30 largest industrialized democracies still had outstanding loans to developing countries totaling $2.4 trillion. That's a lot of leverage hanging out there. Another form of bad lending is when banks lend millions of dollars to hedge funds so that they can leverage their bets. The hedge funds raise $1 from investors, borrow $9 more from banks, and then use that leverage to magnify each of their bets in different stocks, bonds, derivatives, and currencies around the world. Generally speaking, there is nothing wrong with leverage. The typical home mortgage is leveraging. You want people to take advantage of leverage. You want people to take risks, even crazy risks. This is how fledgling enterprises get funded and either go bankrupt or turn into Microsoft. The danger with leverage derives from the fact that the amounts of money that can be lent to hedge funds or emerging markets today are so enormous, and the system is now so greased and integrated that when big risk takers, such as long-term capital management, make big mistakes, they can destabilize everyone. And that is why, since the 1994-95 Mexico peso crisis, the impact on the system of each of the global lending crises of the 1990s and the amount of money that has to be mobilized by governments and international lending institutions to prevent massive domino defaults has been getting larger and larger each time. That is a very dangerous trend line. So now we can frame the problem of bad lending. We want there to be leverage in the system. We want investors to take risks, but we want to reduce the ability of any one individual bank, hedge fund, country, or group of copycat investors to get so over-leveraged that it sets all the dominoes toppling. The question is, how? There are a lot of would-be geo-architects out there all making proposals about how they would reinvent the world to deal with this problem. Henry Kissinger says states need to get together to find a way to tame these markets. Some economists say we need to throw some sand in the gears of the system by taxing certain currency transactions or encouraging governments to impose limited capital controls. Some market types say we need a global central bank that would regulate the global economy the way the U.S. Federal Reserve regulates the American economy. Still others say we need to put limits on the amount of money banks can lend. My own view is that none of these ideas is going to be implemented anytime soon, and many of them are nothing more than hot air, often proposed by people who wouldn't know the difference between a hedge fund and a hedge hog. Let me offer a more realistic approach. To begin with, we need to proceed slowly and humbly. By this I mean that we have to understand that today's global economic system is still so new and so fast that even our best minds don't fully understand how it works and what happens when you pull a lever over here or turn a dial there. Alan Greenspan is a lifelong scholar of international finance, as well as one of its most important practitioners today. But when I asked him in December 1998 about today's globalized financial system, he gave me a rare on-the-record quote that should humble us all. He said, "I have learned more about how this new international financial system works in the last 12 months than in the previous 20 years. As for those who have proposed that we put a little sand in the gears of this global economy to slow it down a bit, my response would be that I don't think it is ever very wise to put sand in the gears of a machine when you barely know where the gears are. If you put sand in the gears of such a fast, lubricated, stainless steel machine, it might not just slow down. It could come to a screeching, metal-bending halt. Also, where do you put the sand when you were dealing with a fund manager sitting in Connecticut using a cellular phone, a high-speed modem, and the Internet to invest in Brazil via a bank domiciled offshore in Panama? It's hard to put sand in a microchip, let alone in cyberspace. Moreover, the minute you start putting taxes on currency transactions, even more banks and hedge funds are going to flee the United States for the regulation light Cayman Islands, already the fifth largest banking center in the world. Long-term capital management, incidentally, was run from Connecticut, but it was chartered in the Cayman Islands. As for those who want to reduce the amounts that banks can lend to hedge funds or emerging markets, I would just point out that the American banking industry has one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington, and these banks will strongly resist any new lending limits which curb their ability not just to lose money, but to make it. Okay, you say, well then, countries should impose capital controls so this hot money won't be able to come in and go out so fast. China today has strict capital controls, and in 1998, Chinese banks, individuals, and corporations managed to elude those controls and funnel billions of dollars out of China using various ruses, so they could play with that money offshore and out of the control of the Chinese state. If an authoritarian regime such as China's cannot effectively impose capital controls, how do you think Brazil is going to? Finally, still others have called for the creation of a global central bank, a U.S. Federal Reserve for the world. This is a wonderful idea, but not something that is going to happen anytime soon. Not as long as we all live in 200 different countries with 200 different governments. So does that mean that there is nothing we can do? No. The good news is that in the wake of the 1998-99 crises, the market, without any new regulation or sand in the gears, disciplined itself to some extent. You saw signs of this everywhere. The chief executives of some of the biggest banks in the world, Barclays PLC, Bank America, United Bank of Switzerland, were all ousted in 1998 after their banks registered huge losses from trading and lending in high-risk emerging markets. And Bankers Trust, which lost $500 million in one quarter of 1998, largely on dealings with Russia, lost its independence as a result. It was taken over by Deutsche Bank. Following these beheadings, all major banks have been restricting leverage, cutting off those fund managers who have gone to excess, demanding more transparency from those to whom they are still lending, and scrutinizing more seriously not just the balance of payments figures of emerging markets, but also their operating systems, legal systems, and overall software. In other words, without any new laws or regulations being passed, everyone in the system started taking the issue of risk management more seriously. Banks started asking fund managers more often, "What is your total exposure and how vulnerable am I as your lender to a worst-case scenario?" Investors started asking fund managers more often, "What are the greatest risks out there that you see for both of us and how are we protected?" And the IMF, the U.S. Treasury, and fund managers all started asking emerging market countries more often, "What are you doing to improve your financial system and regulatory oversight?" And, "What are the flows of private and public money coming in and out of your country? I want to know that constantly and in real time." Fund managers learned that if they were going to continue to raise capital, they were going to have to be more open with both their investors and their bankers. I know a hedge fund manager in London who, in the middle of the 1998 crisis, informed his clients that he had just set up a website. It could only be accessed with a password by clients, but once you were in, you could see on a daily, real-time basis everywhere that this hedge fund was invested, how much it had leveraged, and what the state of each investment was. This hedge fund manager told me, "I know now that if I'm going to attract more investments, I have to provide more transparency. A lot of the leverage came from the banks pushing money out and not knowing what other banks were pushing out at the same time. The banks have behaved like idiots. I could tell the same thing to 20 different bankers each day and they wouldn't know. I am borrowing funds every day, so the banks are going to have to demand at the end of every day's trading to know what my total borrowings are. I already see that starting to happen. The banks are now saying, 'I don't care where you have borrowed, but I want to know where my lending to you fits into your total borrowings.'" The only realistic solution is to find a way to take this ad hoc approach and extend it into the future, until the day when some new global financial regulatory system can be erected. If everyone from the IMF to Merrill Lynch to my Aunt Bev would just ask all these questions more often and keep asking them, we would have a chance of preventing 2 out of the next 5 crises and limiting the impact of 1 out of the next 5. One of the most important things the IMF could do today would be to work with countries to ensure that they publish in a timely and credible fashion much more detailed versions of their overall balance sheets, including the government's outstanding foreign currency obligations and the size and maturity of the private sector's foreign borrowings. There is no greater restraint on human behavior than having other people watching and knowing exactly what you're up to. What you are trying to do is avoid excesses, which can create a sufficiently large amount of risk that it harms not only the people who made the mistake, but a lot of innocent bystanders as well, said William J. McDonough, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which orchestrated the rescue of long-term capital management by private bankers and investors. The key is having and sharing information, If we have the information flow, and sometimes it is just a case of asking a few more questions, we can say to the banks that we regulate that this or that fund is getting too big, and you are helping it get too big. This may not seem very sexy, calling on everyone in the system to become a better regulator, a more open borrower, a smarter investor, and a slightly more prudent banker and lender, but it's time we stopped kidding ourselves. There isn't going to be a global central bank for a long time, and in a world of networks, supermarkets, and super-empowered individuals, including super-empowered investors, there are some things that governments cannot stop and some forces that governments cannot totally control. Therefore, we have to work with the institutions we've got to produce better financial governance without a global central bank telling everyone what to do. It is clear that when the market players impose some discipline on themselves and the regulators take their duties seriously and the IMF takes surveillance seriously, they can have a restraining effect, and they can at least dial down some of the excessive leverage that can threaten the system as a whole. You simply cannot hope for more than that. Today's markets are so big, so diverse, and with the advent of the Internet becoming so fast that they can never be made immune from crises. Global financial crises will be the norm in this coming era. With the speed of change going on today, and with so many countries in different stages of adjustment to this new globalization system, crises will be endemic. So, dear reader, let me leave you with one piece of advice. Fasten your seatbelts and put your seatbacks and tray tables into a fixed and upright position, because both the booms and the busts will be coming faster. Get used to it, and just try to make sure that the leverage in the system doesn't become so great in any one area that it can make the whole system go boom or bust. Anyone who tells you that they have a plan for eliminating all these crises is just pulling your leg. In fact, as you are reading these words, the next global financial crisis is already germinating somewhere. Think of participating in the global economy today like driving a Formula One race car, which gets faster and faster every year. Someone is always going to be running into the wall and crashing, especially when you have drivers who only a few years ago were riding a donkey. You have two choices. You can ban Formula One racing. Then there will never be any crashes. But there also won't be any progress. Or you can do everything possible to reduce the impact of each crash by improving every aspect of the race. That is, you can make sure that there is an ambulance always on hand with a well-trained rescue crew and plenty of blood of different blood types. The market equivalent of that is for the IMF, the G7, and the major world central banks to be able, in an emergency, to inject capital into markets to prevent system-threatening meltdowns. At the same time, you can build each Formula One car stronger. The market equivalent of that is getting every investor who puts a dime into an emerging market to ascertain whether it is developing the operating system and software to properly allocate capital and generate the incomes needed to pay back its lenders. You can focus on training drivers better. The market equivalent of that is making sure that the IMF, investors, and banks are constantly pressing for more and more accurate and timely data on how an economy is developing and where capital, particularly short-term funds, is flowing. And last, you should put as many bales of hay around the track as possible in case a car spins out of control, and to warn drivers that if they are hitting the hay, they are close to hitting the wall. But you don't want so many bales of hay that you impede the race. The market equivalent of that is vigilant banking and financial regulation, circuit breakers and alarm bells to detect and diffuse problems as early as possible. If you don't want to do all these things, then you should forget about Formula One racing and become a jogger. But be careful, because as a jogger in this world, you will very likely be run over by a Formula One car. A geopolitics for the age of globalization. It is not easy for this generation of Americans to grasp how important America is to the world in this era of globalization. Historically, the United States either has been isolated and aloof from world affairs, or has been compelled to enter deeply into the world as part of a moral crusade to fend off another aggressive, threatening power. Isolation is easy to explain and understand. Engagement in a bipolar world with a big, menacing, nuclear-armed Soviet bear always growling on the other side was easy to explain and understand. But what is not easy to explain or understand is engagement in a world in which the United States is the biggest beneficiary and the sole superpower, with multiple secondary powers and with no immediately visible threat, but with many little threats and an abstract, complex globalization system to maintain. But this is the world we have, and in this world, we can't afford either isolation or waiting around for some smaller adversary to become a life-threatening foe. America, as noted earlier, is the Michael Jordan of geopolitics. It's great to be Michael Jordan, and like the commercial said, a lot of people wanted to be like Mike. But as good as Michael Jordan was, he was nothing without the NBA, with its 29 teams and its global television contracts to showcase his skills. So it is with America. We're nothing without the rest of the world, and the world cannot thrive without us. Other nations may want to beat America's brains out in many endeavors, but save for the super-empowered angry men, most of the world also understands that without a strong America, the world would be a much less stable place. Sustainable globalization requires a stable power structure, and no country is more essential for this than the United States. All the internet and other technologies that Silicon Valley is designing to carry digital voices, videos, and data around the world, all the trade and financial integration it is promoting through its innovations, and all the wealth this is generating are happening in a world stabilized by a benign superpower, with its capital in Washington, D.C. The fact that no two major countries have gone to war since they both got McDonald's is partly due to economic integration, but it is also due to the presence of American power and America's willingness to use that power against those who would threaten the system of globalization, from Iraq to North Korea. The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. Markets function and flourish only when property rights are secure and can be enforced, which in turn requires a political framework protected and backed by military power. To ignore the role of military security in an era of economic and information growth is like forgetting the importance of oxygen to our breathing, noted Harvard University government specialist Joseph Nye Jr. Indeed, McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas, the designer of the U.S. Air Force F-15. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies to flourish is called the U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps. And these fighting forces and institutions are paid for by American taxpayer dollars. With all due respect to Silicon Valley, ideas and technology don't just win and spread on their own. Good ideas and technologies also need a strong power that promotes these ideas by example and protects those ideas by winning on the battlefield, says foreign policy historian Robert Kagan. If a lesser power were promoting our ideas and technologies, they would not have the global currency that they have. And when a strong power, the Soviet Union, promoted its bad ideas, they had a lot of currency for more than half a century. This fact is simply too easily forgotten today. For too many executives in Silicon Valley, there is no geography or geopolitics anymore. There are only stock options and electrons. When I asked an all-too-typical tech exec on a 1998 visit to Silicon Valley, when was the last time he had talked about Iraq or Russia or any foreign war, he proudly answered, "Not more than once a year. We don't even care about Washington. Money is extracted by Silicon Valley and then wasted by Washington. I want to talk about people who create wealth and jobs. I don't want to talk about unhealthy and unproductive people. If I don't care about the wealth destroyers in my own country, why would I care about the wealth destroyers in another country?" This view that Washington is the enemy and that any tax dollar paid there is a tax dollar wasted is grotesque. There is a saying in Silicon Valley that loyalty is just one mouse click away. But you can take that too far. Execs there make boasts like, "We are not an American company. We are IBM US, IBM Canada, IBM Australia, IBM China." Oh, yeah? Well, then the next time IBM China gets in trouble in China, you can take that too far. Execs there make boasts like, "We are not an American company. We are IBM US, IBM Canada, IBM Australia, IBM China." Oh, yeah? Well, then the next time IBM China gets in trouble in China, call Jiang Zemin for help. And the next time Congress closes another military base in Asia, and you don't care because you don't care about Washington, call Microsoft's Navy to secure the sea lanes of the Pacific. And the next time the freshman Republicans want to close more U.S. embassies, call Amazon.com to order a new passport. Sure, it may seem unfair that America assumes a disproportionate burden for sustaining globalization. It means there are a lot of free riders, many of whom, like the French, will piggyback on us while criticizing us all along the way. It comes with the role of being a geopolitical shaper. Neither the hidden fist nor the hidden hand will work, though, without also the open hand. The open hand means an America ready to use its wealth to pay a little more than others to stabilize the system and lend a more generous helping hand to others to stabilize the system. Why not? Who benefits most from this system? Did you ever hear Michael Jordan complain about having to carry his team or even the whole NBA on his back? This doesn't mean America needs to be involved everywhere all the time or pay for everything everywhere. There are big important places and there are small unimportant places, and diplomacy is about knowing the difference between the two. And knowing how to mobilize others to act where we cannot or should not go alone. But the very reason we need to support the United Nations and the IMF, NATO, the World Bank, and the various world development banks is that they leverage and magnify our power and our aid. When we deposit a dollar in the Asian Development Bank, it gets loaned out many times over to promote poverty alleviation and free markets. When we pay our UN dues, we fund peacekeeping operations around the world that advance our interests without putting American lives on the line. These multilateral institutions also give those nations adapting to American geopolitical leadership some sense that they have a voice in the decision-making. Maintaining that sense is critical if America is to remain a successful shaper. In order to sustain such a policy, it's pretty clear that those who care about American internationalism are going to have to build a new coalition to support it. The constituency that sustained American internationalism for 50 years and appreciated the importance of America to the rest of the world was the so-called Eastern Intellectual Establishment. That Eastern Establishment, to the extent it even exists today doesn't carry much weight with the I'm an idiot and proud of it congressmen and senators who don't even own passports and boast that they never leave the country. The administration, from whichever party is in power, is going to have to bring together the new globalizers, from the software writers to the human rights activists, from the Iowa farmers to the environmental activists, from the industrial exporters to the high-tech assembly line workers, to form a new 21st century coalition that can defend free trade and American internationalism. I know this is not going to be easy. Americans were ready to pay any price and bear any burden in the Cold War because there was a compelling and immediate sense that their own homes and way of life were at stake. But a large majority don't feel that way about North Korea, Iraq, or Kosovo, and while Russia may still have the capability to pose a lethal threat to America today, it is not doing so at this time. That's why Americans are in the odd position now of being held responsible for everything while being reluctant to die for anything. That's also why in the globalization era, counterinsurgency is out, babysitting is in, house-to-house fighting is out, cruise missiles are in, green berets are out, UN blue helmets are in. In today's world, it seems, there is no war America can lose for long abroad, and no war that it can sustain for long at home. So when the American president today is faced with a military threat, his first question is not, what strategy will work to fundamentally put an end to this threat? Rather, his first question is, how much do I have to pay to get this show off CNN so I can forget about it? Everything gets contained, but nothing gets solved. America truly is the ultimate benign hegemon and reluctant enforcer, but history also teaches us that if you take this reluctance too far, you can threaten the stability of the whole system. Paul Schroeder, professor emeritus of international history at the University of Illinois, is one of the great international historians of the 20th century. He once remarked to me, "If you look at history, the periods of relative peace are those in which there is a durable, stable, and tolerable hegemon who does the adjusting and preserves the minimal necessary norms and rules of the game. And that hegemon always pays a disproportionate share of the collective costs, even foregoes opportunities for conquest, or restrains itself in other ways so as not to build up resentments and to make sure the system stays tolerable for others." This was true, for instance, of the so-called Vienna system from 1815 to 1848, which was dominated by Britain and Russia, two aloof but relatively benign hegemons who enforced the basic rules, but also allowed a lot of local autonomy and prosperity. It was also true in the so-called Bismarckian period under Germany from 1871 to 1890. "The difficulty," says Schroeder, "comes when the benign hegemonic power, which is responsible for keeping the system stable, is unable or unwilling to pay the disproportionate costs to do so, or its hegemony becomes intolerable and predatory rather than benign, or when enough actors rebel against its rules and insist upon a different kind of system that may not benefit that hegemon." That is what we must avoid. The globalization system cannot hold together without an activist and generous American foreign policy. Attention, Kmart shoppers. Without America on duty, there will be no America Online. Olive Trees for the Age of Globalization. After this book was first published, I was shipping a boxload of books to a friend in San Francisco, and a delivery man came to my house to pick them up. The delivery man was a heavy-set, middle-aged African-American, and I invited him into the kitchen to wait while I was signing and packing up the books. Sitting at my kitchen table, he picked up a book and started leafing through it. After a few minutes, he put the book down and said to me, "So the Lexus, that represents technology and computers and stuff?" "That's right," I said. "And the olive tree, that represents community and family and things like that." "That's right," I said. "You've got it." "So tell me something," he said. "Where does God fit into all this? I have been in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ. Where does he fit in?" I had to chuckle, only because I have been asked that question so many times while speaking to groups about this book. Indeed, some of the most oft-asked questions I have gotten are, "Is God in cyberspace? How do I raise my kids in this fast world? And what's it going to do to me and my community?" I believe all three of these questions come from the same source. It is people asking, even if we can get the right politics, geopolitics, geoeconomics, and geomanagement for sustainable globalization, there is another less tangible set of policies that needs to be kept in mind. The olive tree needs in us all. The need for community, for spiritual meaning, and for values with which to raise our children. Those have to be protected and nurtured as well for globalization to be sustainable. One could write a book about these themes alone. Let me sketch out here, in broad strokes, how one might begin to think about them. Let's start with the issue of religion. Is God in cyberspace? That depends on what your view of God is. If your view of God is that he makes his presence felt through divine intervention, through the hand of God at work in the world, then you would have to say that either God is not present in cyberspace, or cyberspace has made you an atheist. Because it is hard to look at cyberspace and say that it is being shaped by the hand of God, given the fact that the most popular sites in cyberspace are pornography, gambling, and pop music. Indeed, it is said that the most oft-used three-letter words on the World Wide Web are sex and MP3, the protocol for downloading rock music. Not God. My own view of God, growing out of my own Jewish tradition, is different. I share the post-biblical view of God. In the biblical view of God, he is always intervening. He is responsible for our actions. He punishes the bad and rewards the good. The post-biblical view of God is that we make God present by our own choices and our own decisions. In the post-biblical view of God, in the Jewish tradition, God is always hidden, whether in cyberspace or the neighborhood shopping center, and to have God in the room with you, whether it's a real room or a chat room, you have to bring him there yourself by your own behavior, by the moral or immoral choices and mouse clicks you make. My teacher, Rabbi Tzvi Marks, pointed out to me that there is a verse in Isaiah that says, "You are my witness, I am the Lord." According to Rabbi Marks, second-century rabbinic commentators interpreted that verse to be saying, "If you are my witness, I am the Lord, and if you are not my witness, I am not the Lord." In other words, explained Rabbi Marks, unless we bear witness to God's presence by our own good deeds, he is not present. Unless we behave as though he were running things, he isn't running things. In the post-biblical world, we understand that from the first day of the world, God trusted man to make choices, when he entrusted Adam to make the right decision about which fruit to eat in the Garden of Eden. We are responsible for making God's presence manifest by what we do. And the reason that this issue is most acute in cyberspace is because no one else is in charge there. There is no place in today's world where you encounter the freedom to choose that God gave man more than in cyberspace. So what I should have told that delivery man was that God is not in cyberspace, but he wants to be there, but only we can bring him there by how we act there. God celebrates a universe of such human freedom because he knows that the only way he is truly manifest in the world is not if he intervenes, but if we all choose sanctity and morality in an environment where we are free to choose anything. As Rabbi Marx puts it, in the post-biblical Jewish view of the world, you cannot be moral unless you are totally free, because if you are not free, you are really not empowered, and if you are not empowered, the choices that you make are not entirely your own. What God says about cyberspace is that you are really free there, and I hope you make the right choices, because if you do, I will be present. There is nothing about globalization or the Internet that eliminates the need for ideals or codes of restraint on human behavior. The more we are dependent on this technology, the more we need to come to it armed with our own ideals and codes of restraint. Indeed, the reason God so much wants to be in cyberspace, and the reason we should want him there, argues Israeli religious philosopher David Hartman, is because in some ways cyberspace is the world that the prophets spoke about, a place where all mankind can be unified and be totally free. The danger is that we are unifying mankind in cyberspace, all speaking one language, all using one medium, but without God. And we certainly don't want to be unifying mankind through the Internet without any value system, without any filters, without any alternative conception of meaning other than business, and without any alternative view of human beings other than as consumers looking for the lowest price. But these much-needed values are best learned offline, outside the Internet. The only way people are going to find God on the Internet is if they bring him there in their own heads and hearts and behaviors, drawing on values they learn in the terrestrial world, in the olive groves of their parents' home or their community, church, synagogue, temple, or mosque. Which leads to another frequently asked olive tree question. How do I prepare my kids for the fast world? A lot more parents in America started to think about that after they realized that the news stories about the 1999 shootings at Columbine High School contained two sets of initials they never saw thrown together in the news before, NRA and AOL. That the NRA, the National Rifle Association, should feel guilty about the Columbine massacres went without saying. The idea that two high school kids were able to use their allowances to amass an arsenal that included the Intratech AB-10, a fingerprint-resistant high-volume paramilitary assault weapon, a high-point 9mm carbine, a sawed-off pump-action shotgun, and a sawed-off double-barreled shotgun should make anyone who opposes gun control ashamed of themselves. But what about AOL, America Online, the Internet provider that housed the warped website of Eric Harris, one of the student gunmen? The AOL web postings attributed to Mr. Harris included instructions on how to build pipe bombs. Shrapnel is very important. An illustration of a creature toting a shotgun and a knife while standing on a pile of skulls. And the song lyrics, "What I don't do, I don't like. What I don't like, I waste." Should we as parents be as worried about the Internet as the Intratech? The short answer is no. AOL is not the equivalent of the NRA. But that doesn't quite end the matter. As the Internet moves into the center of our lives, how we communicate, educate, and do business in the new millennium, we have to remember something essential. What makes the Internet so exciting and troubling is that, unlike the New York Times, for example, it has no editor, no publisher, and no censor. You and your kids interact with the network totally naked. But precisely because the Internet is such a neutral, free, open, and unregulated vehicle for commerce, education, and communication, personal judgment and responsibility are critical when using this technology. The only real filter is the one your kids bring in their own heads or hearts when they go online. And since kids often lack the judgment microchip, it is even more critical that parents and educators provide it. If we don't all take responsibility for building the internal software into our kids so that they can interact with this naked technology properly, we are going to have a problem. I grew up in a small suburb of Minneapolis. You had to go at least an hour from my house to find trouble. On the internet, trouble is just a few mouse clicks away. You can wander into a virtual neo-Nazi beer hall or pornographer's library, hack the NASA computers, or roam the Sorbonne library, and no one is there to stop or direct you. To put it another way, the more the internet makes us all broadcasters, all researchers, all consumers, and all retailers, and, alas, all potential bomb makers, the more critical it is that our teachers, parents, and communities are still making us all citizens. That's work that can only be done offline. The internet and computers are just tools, wonderful tools that can extend and expand one's reach enormously. But you still need to know what to grasp and how to get the best out of them. These tools can help you think, but they can't make you smart. They can browse and search, but they can't judge. They can enable you to interact far and wide, but they teach you nothing about how to be a good neighbor. They can empower you to touch the lives of many people, but they can't tell you what to say at a PTA meeting or why to say it. That's the parenting paradox of the internet. The best thing parents can do to prepare their kids for the internet age is not to teach them more whiz-bang high-tech skills or buy their kids faster modems and computers, but rather to stress more old-fashioned fundamentals. The faster your kids' modems, the faster they can get online, the stronger must be their own personal software if you want to see them thrive. And personal software can only be built the old-fashioned way, by stressing reading, writing, and arithmetic, church, synagogue, temple, mosque, and family. Those things can't be downloaded from the internet. They can only be uploaded by parents and teachers, priests and rabbis. And that's why, if I had one wish, it would be that every modem that is sold would come with a Surgeon General's warning on it. It would say, "Judgment not included." You have to provide that yourself, the old-fashioned way, from under the olive tree. I began this book with a discussion of Cain and Abel, and I will end it with a discussion of the Tower of Babel. What was the problem with the Tower of Babel? Isn't it what globalizers dream about today? A world in which we all speak the same language, have the same currency, follow the same accounting practices? It was precisely their sameness that allowed the people of the world in biblical times to cooperate and build that Tower of Babel, to build a tower that might actually reach to the heavens. I was talking about this one afternoon with my friend Rabbi Marks when he suddenly looked up from his coffee and asked, "Was the Tower of Babel the original version of the Internet?" After all, the Internet, too, is a sort of universal language outside the bounds of any particular culture. It is a universal mode of communication that, at least on the surface, seems to make us all intelligible to one another, even if we don't all speak the same language. And it allows us to connect with all sorts of people with whom we never shared an olive grove. But what did God do with the Tower of Babel? He put a stop to it. And how did he put a stop to it? By making the people all speak different languages so they could no longer cooperate. Why did God do that? Rabbi Marks explains it like this. God did it in part because he felt that the people were trying to transcend their own human limitations in building a tower to the heavens in a way that might challenge him. But he also destroyed the tower because he felt their common language and approach was ultimately dehumanizing. It denied all particularity in men and women in favor of a universal language and a universal project. And therefore, God's solution and his punishment was to stop the tower by making all the people speak different languages. It was God's way of getting people back in touch with and in balance with their olive trees, which reflect their own individuality and their particular links to a place, a community, a culture, a tribe, and a family. Yes, globalization and the Internet can bring together people who have never been connected before, like my mom and her French Internet bridge partners. But rather than creating new kinds of communities, this technology often just creates a false sense of connection and intimacy. It's like two beepers communicating with each other. Can we really connect with others through email, or internet bridge, or chat rooms? Or is all this standardizing technology just empowering us to reach farther into the world while exempting us from the real work required to build relationships and community with the folks next door? I used to chat with and meet people from all over the world while riding the ski lifts up the mountains in Colorado. I still ride the lifts, but now everyone has a cellular phone. So instead of meeting people from all over the world on the lifts, now I just overhear their conversations on their cellular phones with their offices all over the world. I really hate that. Email is not building a community. Attending a PTA meeting is. A chat room is not building a community. Working with your neighbors to petition City Hall for a new road is. Can we really build cyber communities that will replace real communities? I'm very dubious. That's why I, for one, won't be surprised if I wake up one day and discover that the Almighty has made the Internet crash just the way he did the Tower of Babel. I keep thinking about this young Kuwaiti I met at the Internet Cafe in Kuwait City, who told me, "When I was a student, we didn't have the Internet. What we had were a few liberal professors, and we would get together with them quietly in their homes and talk about politics. Now, as a student, you can sit at home and converse with the whole world." But he confessed, he and his professors don't get together anymore like they used to. There is a danger that, as a result of the interneting of society, the triumph of all this technology in our lives, and globalization über alles, people will wake up one morning and realize that they don't interact with anyone except through a computer. When this happens, people will really become vulnerable to those preachers and New Age religious fantasies that come along and promise to reconnect us to our bodies, our souls, and the olive tree in us all. This is when you will start to see truly crazy revolts against monotony and standardization, people being different for the sake of being different, but not on the basis of any real historical memory, roots, or traditions. Balancing a Lexus with an olive tree is something every society has to work on every day. It is also what America, at its best, is all about. America, at its best, takes the needs of markets, individuals, and communities all utterly seriously. And that's why America, at its best, is not just a country. It's a spiritual value and a role model. It's a nation that is not afraid to go to the moon, but also still loves to come home for Little League. It is the nation that invented both cyberspace and the backyard barbecue, the Internet and the social safety net, the SEC and the ACLU. These dialectics are at the heart of America, and they should never be resolved in favor of one over the other. But they should also never be taken for granted. They have to be constantly nurtured, tended to, and preserved. And we can do this by supporting our public schools, paying our taxes, understanding that the government is not the enemy, and always making sure we're still getting to know our neighbors over the fence and not over the web. America is not at its best every day, but when it's good, it's very, very good. In the winter of 1994, my oldest daughter, Orly, was in the fourth grade chorus at Burning Tree Elementary School in Bethesda, Maryland. At Christmas time, all the choruses from the local public elementary schools got together for a huge performance in the Bethesda Town Square. I came to hear my daughter sing. The chorus conductor was an African-American man, and for the holiday song fest, he wore a Santa Claus outfit. The first song the chorus sang that evening was the Hanukkah classic, Maoz Sur, to the tune of Rock of Ages. Watching this scene and hearing that song brought tears to my eyes. When I got home, my wife Ann asked me how it was. And I said to her, "Honey, I just saw a black man dressed up as Santa Claus directing 400 elementary school kids singing Maoz Sur in the town square of Bethesda, Maryland. God bless America." A healthy, global society is one that can balance the Lexus and the olive tree all the time, and there is no better model for this on Earth today than America. And that's why I believe so strongly that for globalization to be sustainable, America must be at its best, today, tomorrow, all the time. It not only can be, it must be, a beacon for the whole world. Let us not squander this precious legacy.
The End. You've been listening to The Lexus and the Olive Tree by Thomas L. Friedman, narrated by George Wilson. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.